Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Welcome one and all, be you Ironborn, Stormborn, or Bastardborn, to Kotaku Split Screen's special coverage of Game of Thrones Season 7. My name is Kirk Hamilton, I'm the editor-at-large at Kotaku.com. I am joined by Kotaku News editor Jason Schreier to discuss the third episode of Season 7, The Queen's Justice. As always, we will discuss the events from the books, but we will not discuss leaked stuff about the show or the next time on preview, which we do not watch. Jason, this episode had some poison, some warfare, and some very tense talking. Big picture, what did you think?
I thought you were going to say Battleborn, and I got really excited there.
We could have finally talked about Battleborn on this show.
I thought this was a good episode. I have kind of mixed feelings about it. I thought it was an overall interesting, entertaining episode, maybe marred by some bad acting and Bran, because fuck Bran. What did you think, Kirk?
I thought it was a cool episode that sort of reassured me on some of the fronts we had talked about a couple of episodes ago about whether or not this show might devolve into just like an action-packed show versus a show about relationships. I thought that it was the fact that they like dedicated huge 20-minute chunks of the episode to just two characters standing in a room and talking and then actually glossed over some major battle sequences sort of made me happy, actually, because I didn't need to see more war, but I did really want them to take their time, especially with John and Danny meeting, and I thought that was really handled well. So before we get into the episode, as usual, we have a few loose ends that we should tie up from last week. I believe maybe a correction or something. What should we start with?
Yeah, so I was re-listening to last week's episode, and I realized that I kept saying John Cunningham when his name is actually John Connington.
Oh, so, my God. Bit of what an embarrassing mistake.
that's his real name.
Okay, got it. One thing that I should mention from last week that I wasn't aware of, that I think we weren't aware of. So we discussed Arya and Nymeria, both of whom do not appear in this episode. But we talked a little bit about the ambiguity surrounding that line where she said, it's not you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So apparently I don't watch the post-show thing where like they interview the creators and the writers and stuff. So apparently on that show, Benioff and Weiss said that line is actually a callback to Season 1, which there have actually been a lot of cool callbacks to Season 1, but apparently that line was what Ned said to Arya when he said to her, like, oh, you're going to be a princess or a lady one day in your own castle. And then he looks at her and he goes, that's not you. Because he kind of realizes that that's not her. So the kind of common interpretation of the scene is that it was Arya looking at Nymeria and saying, oh, Nymeria, like, come back with me. We'll be a family again. You'll be my doggy. We'll be friends. And then she sort of looked at her and said, that's not you. Like Ned said to her when she was younger, sort of recognizing that Nymeria was now
meant to be a wild wolf.
Right. And which is also then definitely sort of also a commentary on Arya's status as well.
Right.
So that was sort of the, it's always like, I don't love watching those scenes only because it's fun to interpret stuff on our own and not have the creators tell us what they meant. But that was their sort of intent with that line. And I think I at least totally missed that was a line callback to Ned Stark and didn't pick that up. So yeah, so that's that.
Yeah, there have been a lot of callbacks this Season 1. A lot of stuff that I had forgotten or that is very specific stuff. That, and in fact, a large part of Jon and Tyrion talking in this week's episode was just them bringing up things that happened in Season 1.
Yeah, that was one of my big notes on this episode was how much. And then, I mean, last season or last episode too, but there's just been so much calling back to Season 1, which is really cool because all of these things that began, that was the beginning and this is the ending. And so it's fitting that they would be referencing so many things about how it began. So I guess let's get into it because that segues us right into what happens. So we begin with Jon and Daenerys. Really, we begin with Jon and Tyrion. So Jon meets Tyrion sees Tyrion for the first time in, you know, I guess in a very, very long time since they saw each other at the wall in season
one. So I don't know, did Jon and Davos and their buddies, did they just come down on these rowboats from like Winterfell to Dragonstone? How did that even happen?
So a lot, I think this episode finally just completely throws ideas of time continuity like out the window, that this stuff is remotely happening at the same time. I'm not, if someone
but it's
sat
not
down
e- No, and, that's not the question I was asking. It's not just time continuity. It's more like there's this giant war going on in Westeros. How did they get from Winterfell to Dragonstone without running into soldiers, without getting
without
like,
running into
by
like
pirates,
like psychic Euron Greyjoy, who always manages to turn up exactly where he needs to be? I guess because they needed to.
Right.
I was amazed by just at the beginning of the episode. I was like, oh shit, Jon's at Dragonstone. This is, we're already there. It didn't, you know, I feel like in an earlier season that would have taken four episodes until he finally arrives. And instead it's like, nope, he's there at the very beginning of this episode.
They're in a rush. Yeah, I don't mind that. I just don't understand how him and his contingent of like five other soldiers managed to get across all of Westeros, because Dragonstone and Winterfell are very far apart.
Yeah, sort of unclear. So Jon meets with Tyrion. Tyrion and Jon sort of have a slightly tense but okay, you know, reunion. They give up their weapons. They go to meet Daenerys. There's a great, very long conversation between Jon and Daenerys where Daenerys is being pretty hardcore, wants Jon to bend the knee. Jon refuses. Jon tells her about the White Walker. She seems sort of unmoved by that. Mm-hmm. Everything is very tense. Tyrion is working, trying desperately to keep them on the same page and to keep Jon in the room. There's an exchange of honorifics that's very funny, where Daenerys is huge list of titles and then Jon is just sort of king in the north.
Yeah,
Davos almost mentions that Jon died and came back, but Jon cuts him off. The Daenerys notices.
Yeah, clearly, and that'll be a plot point.
Oh yeah, definitely. And then they both kind of talk about like it. It's nice. They kind of both talk about where they came from, and it's clear they have so much in common, but they're just not getting there. And right when things are about to go south, Varys comes in and tells Daenerys about Euron's raid, and that sort of breaks up the tension and breaks up the meeting. And they both, he stays in Dragonstone, and they kind of break up. So what did you think of this scene, Jason?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. I mean, first of all, my prediction at the beginning of season that Jon and Daenerys are just going to totally do it is obviously going to happen, because
they are
clearly getting set up for this romance. The problem is, I mean, so I really dig that stuff. I dig them exchanging words and bantering and talking politics and all that jazz. The problems for me are that A, the acting is not very good. I think both Jon and Daenerys are kind of subpar performances. Emma Clarke is better, I think, and she has grown into her role a little bit more than Jon has over time, but still not the best. And Jon just has no chemistry with anybody. The two of them just don't have any chemistry together. And maybe they need more time to develop it, but there isn't much time for that to happen. So I think that is a major failing of all these scenes between the two of them, is that they're just not as captivating on the screen as, say, Jaime and Olenna Tyrell, who are both tremendous actors who just have this buzz. Like, you can, there's these sparks between the two of them, and we'll get to that a little bit later. But or like Varys and Melisandre, who are both way better actors. So that, I think, detracts from that whole plot a lot and makes me wish that we were watching other people. But I do like the conflict there, and I think it'll be interesting to see how that's resolved, because how the hell is Jon going to convince Daenerys to go north? Or is Daenerys going to convince Jon to stay with her for a while, and maybe they'll fight Cersei together and then head north, but will they run out of time first? I don't know. It's leaving me with interesting questions. What do you think of that section?
I liked the scene as well. I agree with you that especially, I think Kit Harington is just like not really a great actor, and
it really makes the show suffer, and has,
so it,
I think.
Well, I mean, like any not great actor will make any show suffer, and yeah, I mean, Emma Clarke, I think, has kind of grown into looking intense and having, you know, speaking very intensely. And it's definitely interesting that I think the actor who plays Davos is really great.
Yeah.
And you know, Tyrion,
Liam
obviously.
Cunningham, is that his name? Liam?
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Uh-oh, am I using Cunningham incorrectly?
I think I've got to make sure now so we don't have to issue a correction.
I'm checking. Yes, Liam Cunningham, it is.
Liam Cunningham, and obviously Peter Dinklage is great as Tyrion. So
yes.
They are these kind of two really good actors in the background. And I thought that Davos got some really great stuff to work with. I mean, that line, that really cracked me up, where he's like, this is Jon Snow. He's king of the North. He's like, I don't really do this. I don't know. Where Missandei is so good at doing her, you know, Sturm und Drang introduction of Daenerys.
Yes.
So I liked that. I liked that the scene just... went on long enough, I guess. This isn't, and you know, I think we'll talk more about, because this, you know, they come back to Dragonstone later in the episode. This is a sort of a drawn out process, and I just appreciated that the show is taking its time with the two of them working their thing out. I actually didn't get a romantic vibe. I totally agree that that seems possible, probable, maybe likely. But I didn't really get a very romantic vibe between the two of them, which I appreciated. I was like, look, both of them have bigger fish to fry. Neither of them are very interested in doing this. And especially from Daenerys' point of view, it's not yet clear why Jon Snow would even be an acceptable suitor. He's basically just this barbarian from the north that she doesn't know anything about.
Yeah. There were also, did you notice all of the little things? There was a lot of talking about people's parents. She kept talking about his father, and he kept talking about her father, and a lot of little subtle things that were like,
oh, yeah,
wait a minute, your dad is actually Rhaegar. And they
right,
kept
well,
bringing
they were
up.
Even,
like,
yeah. Then yeah. Later they like reference Rhaegar and she talks yep. about him, and I'm like, oh, yeah. This is interesting. And yeah. There have been, I mean, even in that last episode, them talking about how you can never trust a Targaryen to Jon mm-hmm. Snow, who yep. is a Targaryen. Like, there's been a lot of that cleverness happening. Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed the line by Melisandre saying that she brought ice and fire together.
Yes. So anyways, I liked the scene. I liked that it was tense in the way that it was. I sort of understood where they were both coming from. And then, right, so it ended kind of when it needed to end. To get to Melisandre, she, yeah, basically... makes the right call. I was sort of worried that she would be around when mm-hmm. they arrived, and then it would be a whole thing with her and Davos, which I just didn't...
No, like, well, the last time, I don't know if you remember from last season, the last time they saw her, they yes. exiled her, and they said, if we yes. see you again, we're going to kill you.
Right, and that's why I was worried that they were going to see her again in this
gotcha.
Scene, and then they were going to, and it was going to be this whole point of tension where
yeah, yeah, yeah.
he immediately wants to attack her, and then the whole thing falls apart. Instead, she is wisely just says, "No, I'm going to get out of here, and get out of your hair because I'll be more trouble than I'm worth." And makes
that
I
was
think,
a fascinating scene.
That was a fascinating scene, and she says basically to Varys, "I'll return." He says, "You know, I don't think you should come back." And she says, "Oh, I'm going to come back, and I'm going to die here, and so are you." And then
yep.
she sort of leaves, and he gives this look, and it was very, I mean, clear that like this show kind of plays fast and loose, the predicting the future, but that felt to me like something that is definitely going to happen. Do you agree?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I always enjoy seeing Varys get caught off guard, because he's not yeah. a guy who usually gets caught off guard. He's usually in control and knows exactly what's going on. And mm-hmm. his evolution as a character since season one has been really fun to watch and really interesting. And yeah, the two of them have some interesting. That interaction was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I liked it as well. I like Varys whenever he rolls in. I will say that I'm a little... I feel like maybe part of his evolution is that he's lost some of his network, because he does seem to... They do keep getting blindsided by Euron Greyjoy. They don't... Mm-hmm. Like, Varys doesn't really have any little birds in Euron's fleet, apparently, because Euron keeps totally taking them by surprise.
I'm actually curious, does Varys have any little birds? Because Qyburn, Maester Qyburn, has taken mm-hmm. all of the little children in King's Landing.
Yeah, I mean, I think Daenerys made a reference to him, to Varys' knowledge. I doubt that Varys is totally without knowledge. He seems uh-huh. to know some of what's going on, but it does seem as though he and Tyrion are getting taken by surprise, at least in this episode and the last episode, pretty routinely
yes.
by Cersei and Jaime and Euron. So
yes.
moving to Euron, who is in the middle of taking them by surprise, he has now taken Yara and Alaria and Alaria's daughter Tyene, whose name I didn't even know last week, to Cersei as a gift to her. He presents really Alaria, who killed Myrcella, to Cersei, says, you know, here's your gift. Will you marry me now? Cersei says, oh, I'll totally marry you after the war. And mm-hmm. he just believes her. Then he spends a lot of time like taunting Jaime and being like, oh, you're such a dick. You suck, which just seems really stupid.
Euron sucks so much.
Yeah, Euron really sucks.
And it's not even like I love to hate him like you do Ramsay Bolton or no. Joffrey. It's like he just sucks.
And it's funny because like I didn't even love to hate Ramsay Bolton. I was sick of Ramsay Bolton like pretty early on in his reign. But at least he was an established character, and he spent a long spent a long time getting to know him. Where Euron is just
he just came out of nowhere.
It's like, who is this asshole? Like what? Yeah. And then his whole strategy, he just seems stupid for a guy who's preternaturally able to just turn up and fuck shit up like at the perfect worst moment for the other side. He's such he seems like an idiot. What kind of an idiot would go in and do what he's doing, which is basically he's trying to woo Cersei, and then he's just constantly picking fights and taunting Jaime for some reason. Like he thinks Jaime isn't dangerous anymore, which is just so stupid. Like it makes no sense.
I mean, I think he only exists to set up, and we'll get to this later when we talk about Jaime and Olenna, but I think he only exists to be part of what will eventually provoke Jaime to save the realm by killing Cersei.
Which is annoying because really he doesn't, we don't need him to do that. I think Jaime and Cersei's dynamic is interesting enough on its own.
Yeah, agreed.
And like having, like it always just bothers me, I guess, when people on shows do things that are obviously dumb and not in their self-interest. Mm-hmm. And him taunting Jaime instead of being just a little bit smart is so dumb and not in his self-interest, considering that he's sort of being a smart political manipulator. Like I was surprised that he even knew that Ilaria was responsible for killing Myrcella. The flow of information on this show has gotten pretty fast and loose and confusing at times.
Yeah, and Daenerys, there was one point where Daenerys brings up to Jon, like, you have one brother or something like that. And I was like, how the hell would she know how many brothers he has left?
Right. But then there are also times where people totally don't know anything and haven't heard, you know, like how Arya hadn't even heard about the Battle of the Bastards. Like, so it's very, it feels like they're playing fast and loose, which isn't the end of the world. I don't really care.
Well, it makes sense that people in castles like Euron and Daenerys would have more information than Arya was just traveling in the wilderness.
Right. But it still seems as though when the show needs someone to know something, they just know it, regardless of where they are. And like, that's fine if that's what they need to do to get where they need to get. They have a lot of ground to cover. Fair enough. But there are times where I'm a little bit like, what? Like with Euron, someone who would be smart enough and well-informed enough to have this information, he rolled out really without any support from Cersei. He just did this on his own. Uh-huh. And he figured out, you know, exactly where to go and what to do. And then he's still stupid enough to be taunting, you know, Jaime, who Cersei clearly still loves, and Jaime still loves her, even as complicated as the relationship has gotten. It just seems like a really dumb move.
Speaking of dumb moves, why is Euron keeping Yara alive?
Well, so the Yara thing is unclear. I guess we'll probably get to that. I feel like Yara is probably doomed, even though I guess with Theon still alive. He can, and we can just
also
mention
Theon
right
there was
now.
That one scene where Theon showed up on it. Who were the people on that boat? Was that other Greyjoys?
I believe. Yeah. I believe that those were people loyal to Theon. They were like
his crew
or like people of among his group, or they would have killed him. Like they weren't Euron's fleet because Euron's fleet was long gone.
Okay.
So I think that they were like surviving Ironborn. Yeah, so they rescue Theon and they kind of just like shit on him. I guess with Yara still alive, there's a chance that that's where Theon's going.
But it makes no sense that Euron would keep her alive because she has no value as a prisoner because he commands the Iron Fleet. So there's nobody he could leverage her against.
You're right, and it's not clear that he is even keeping her alive because he didn't really say anything.
That he paraded her through the streets.
Well, and I mean, I think maybe, who knows, like he's planning something for her down the road. I think there is, so let's get to the next scene because there is someone keeping someone alive in a way that I think might come back and bite them in the ass. So Cersei takes Ilaria and Tyene into the dungeon. She sort of taunts them, she talks a lot about how she's gonna kill them, and then she uses the same lipstick that was used to kill Myrcella to kiss. She kisses Tyene and tells Ilaria, you're going to watch as your beautiful daughter dies and decomposes in front of you. So first off, that scene, I don't know, like I feel like it was so supervillain. Like it was interesting because it said something about Cersei. Like we know that she's so bent on revenge, she's kind of still just like, she has not forgotten about the stuff that's happening. She's not focused on ruling. She's still focusing on settling scores. But also, leaving Ilaria alive in the dungeon just strikes me as a total, like, James Bond villain thing to do, to leave someone like that alive.
Well, I actually thought I actually assumed that that would be the last we see of them, because that just seemed like a good conclusion to that arc, and there's no reason to bring them back. But
I kind of think we'll see Ilaria again.
You think so?
Because she would have killed her if she was going to kill her. She would have been like, and then we'll kill you or something, and that's the end. And it would have felt more final.
I felt like the show wanted me to walk away from that scene thinking, oh my God, Cersei is so malicious, she's so evil. But to me, I was like rooting for Cersei in that scene, because she's getting revenge on this woman who killed her teenage daughter, her innocent teenage daughter, the same way. And like for her, like I felt like Cersei totally deserved that revenge. And also the sand stakes sucks so much that I was totally rooting for Cersei.
You know, it's interesting. I think, I don't know about rooting for Cersei, but I did think that episode, I was sort of dreading that scene. I knew the episode was called The Queen's Justice. I knew that they had captured Ilaria. I was sure Cersei was going to get some measure of revenge. And I was kind of dreading the horrible thing that Cersei might do to Ilaria. Like the way that she had the mountain do whatever the hell the mountain did to the Septa at the end of last season.
That also felt like it was justified.
Okay, but that was like really fucked up, and in a way that actually this scene kind of wasn't, because one thing that struck me about this episode was that as much as there was kind of a high body count and there was a lot of battles, it wasn't all that violent. Like her revenge on Ilaria it was like this poetic revenge where she used this poison. It was very like psychologically violent. But it wasn't, she didn't have her daughter flayed in front of her. We weren't forced to watch some horrible, violent act.
Right.
And so actually that, and then that was kind of true for this whole episode, which I thought was sort of interesting, that I feel like that it was a different sort of a vengeance from the vengeance that Cersei has taken before. You know, leaving a woman to be like violated and ripped apart by a giant zombie is like one thing. Poisoning her daughter in front of her is like a very different kind of punishment. And I thought that was just interesting. Like, that was an interesting part of
it.
It
was
scene.
A punishment that fit the crime. A Lannister always pays her debt. And that was the debt that she owed. This was all about Cersei. This entire episode was Cersei getting revenge on people who killed her children.
Yeah. Even if she maybe didn't even know that's what she was doing. I was also struck by her lipstick in the scene. I was like, wow, she's wearing some really bright red lipstick at the beginning and didn't think it through, didn't realize what was going to happen until she kissed her. And then I was like, okay, so that's why she's wearing that.
Yep. I also didn't think about it until then.
So after the scene, Cersei is filled with vigor, vim and vigor, and rushes and grabs Jaime and starts going down on him. Questionably puts a finger in his butt. Was that what was going on there? Was that like a reference back to Euron asking Jaime whether she liked that?
Because then
she
like, that's funny. No, I
that's kind of what it looked like.
I didn't notice that, but I was thinking, oh my God, I hope she got all of the lipstick off, because if there was even like a tiny bit left, that would be so painful.
That would be a bummer way to go down. I liked that one small thing about that. So I thought it was funny that they at least teased toward the idea that Jaime is actually into that. And also that they showed him with his stump, I think, for the first time in quite a while. He was sort of sitting there with his hand off, not in his armor. It was very like the scene began with Jaime in a very sort of vulnerable state, where we've seen him mostly just standing in his armor with his gold hand, looking very sturdy. And this was more, you know, him as a human. And then, of course, they get back together and they sort of have this rekindling, which it's not totally clear that Jaime and Cersei have rekindled their romance since he's been back.
Like, no, and they kind of haven't. And he also has to deal with like Euron now, who she has promised to wed.
Right.
So that was never discussed between the two of them, which I'm sure will be an ongoing
letting the servants see them without really getting his okay. Like, she's just like, whatever, I'm the queen, I can do it. And he's like, well, I kind of am not into that, and she doesn't care. Yeah, there's clearly, I think, a lot of things in this episode and before have indicated there is a coming conflict between them. So, still in King's Landing, we get a scene that sort of happened in the books, but I think hasn't happened on the show yet, where a visitor from the Iron Bank, played by Mycroft Holmes, I don't remember the actor's actual name, but that's the guy who plays Mycroft Holmes on Sherlock Holmes, turns up and says to Cersei, basically, your debts are mounting, the Lannisters are out of money, have been for a while, the Iron Bank needs to collect, and they sort of have a discussion over the Iron Bank betting on the various people. This is the Braavos Iron Bank betting on various parties in this war and who they think will come out on top and be able to pay them back. So what did you make of this?
So scene? some history about the Iron Bank. The Iron Bank in the show, the Iron Bank had bet on Stannis before and lost that bet. And then in season five, Cersei sent Mace Tyrell to Braavos to meet with the bank. And that was when he brought along Meryn Trant, who Arya killed, and we never really saw any sort of resolution between Tyrell and the bank. So it wasn't really clear what was happening there and how that resolved. And so this is the first time we've seen the bank since then. There are a lot of things that don't make sense here because she is talking to the Iron Banker about the slave trade and how that must have hurt their economy and how he has to support them because like Cersei will return things to the status quo. But here's the thing. Braavos, the city of Braavos was built by freed slaves, and the entire principle of Braavos, it's called one of the free cities, is that they don't believe in slavery. They fought against slavery. So for the Iron Bank to be supported, like, it makes no sense. There's no, this is just contradictory to the entire history of Westeros for the Iron Banker of Braavos to suddenly be in support of the slave trade. Braavos has fought wars against slavery, and the Iron Bank is like, none of them are pro slaves. So a lot of plot holes here.
Yeah, it felt a little like they wanted to, this is kind of a show versus like the show not fully going all deep on the like actual true lore of Westeros and just sort of being like, well, this like makes sense if Cersei uses it. Because Cersei, it seemed to me like she convinced the banker by the end that she was still the safest bet, which actually, like, judging by the events of this episode, Cersei is nowhere near as fucked as she seemed at the beginning of this season. So maybe the right call. One line that I really liked that I think you, as someone who occasionally gambles, would like. I really liked when she says, "So you make bets." And he says, "We don't make bets. We invest in endeavors we deem likely to succeed." And she's like, "Dude, it's a bet. A bet by any other name is still a bet." I thought that was a
funny
line.
I'm going to Vegas in a couple months to invest in some endeavors that I think are likely to succeed.
You deem likely to succeed.
Invest in my endeavors at the craps tables.
Yeah, it was an interesting scene. I'm not sure where it's going. It seems like they're introducing it. Like, everything that happens now happens for a reason. They introduced that scene for a reason, so.
Yeah, there are some things. So the thing about Cersei, I don't know if it's Cersei or Cersei. I kind of say Cersei.
I think the show says Cersei, but I get why you would say.
Cersei, I mean, this is a lady who has been shown time and time again to be so ambitious and power hungry that she makes a lot of stupid moves, like when she, for example, caused the rise of the Sparrows. And while I guess the show is trying to show her evolution, for her to suddenly become this master manipulator who, I think it was the banker who said that she reminded him of her father, for her to suddenly become the next Tywin is not really logical. I mean, like, for her to make such a drastic evolution just because she went through this tragic, like, walk of shame and getting tortured and seeing her children die. I mean, it makes no sense that she would suddenly become this master strategy.
But the way you describe that, it does make sense that she would change, right? So I don't know. I don't totally not buy it. Like, she's been through so much.
She would change, but how would she suddenly turn? I mean, this is a woman who just a couple seasons ago, so maybe a few months ago in the show's time, was someone who thought it would be smart to arm the faith and allow them to rise to power, and made the most catastrophic mistake she could possibly make. And now she's suddenly outwitting Tyrion, her brother, who has always been shown as the actual strategist and the guy who actually received the brains from Tywin.
It's interesting. And I mean, I think there's probably more here that I haven't fully like investigated. I remember there was this big discussion between her and, I guess, was it Littlefinger? It was Littlefinger or Varys. It was Littlefinger. This conversation of what is power? Is knowledge power, or is power power?
Yeah.
And it was sort of this like little mission statement for the show, where at the time Cersei said power is power, because she tells her Kingsguard to kill, she's like, kill him now, no, stop, and she's like, I have the true power, because I like, might makes power. And it would kind of make sense that Cersei would reevaluate that position after having failed kind of pretty considerably and made it through, but like had that philosophy betray her time and time
again. Well,
there's
a difference between reevaluating a position and suddenly turning into a master strategist.
Oh, sure. I mean, some of that is just convenient. And it's not totally clear that she really is a master strategist. Like, I think the one thing that's sort of missing for me from her side of the battle is the sense that there's somebody there actually coming up with these plans, which I think is like a dramatic necessity for the show, because the show keeps wanting to surprise us with these surprise attacks, or, you know, that whole closing montage, which we'll talk about later, was all very like surprising because it wasn't what we expected.
Yes.
And so that kind of only works if they don't tell us what Cersei is planning. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of missing, her war room is missing the scene where somebody says, there's some genius or tactical, you know, master tactician saying, oh, we should do this and this and this, right, even after the fact, like explaining who the hell even came up with these ideas. Was it Euron? Was it Jaime?
I guess it could be Qyburn. It's kind of implied that Qyburn is the brains
behind.
Yeah,
is he really a tactician, or he seems like more like a researcher?
Or Jaime. Jaime is also a pretty good general.
Yeah,
I
guess
sure
that'd be my guess, but I would like just one scene that sort of establishes that.
Yeah, so, no, I agree with you. Yeah, that's a good point. And then the other thing is, I think it's in that conversation with the banker where she talks about how dragons have a vulnerability, and yeah. I kept thinking about it. Oh yeah, our crossbow. It's really going to get the job done.
But the thing is, you know, the crossbow's going to kill one of the dragons.
Of course.
And it is like, so I guess it is, there's been quite a bit of discussion of the big crossbow over the last week. It is in the books, right? Like, this is something that people did before to fight off dragons. Like, they have used these sorts of crossbows, and they do work. Like, it is a way of killing dragons. So I'm sure one of the dragons is going to die to that thing. Yeah. It's one of the things, like I was just saying, like how everything is important. Like, the Iron Bank scene was important. Everything is important. And so when you see something like that, it's not just going to be a red herring. Like, some dragon is going to take an arrow. Like, the Iron Bank is going to play an important role. Like, each time we see a scene, we know, which is a little like, I don't know. It's like last seasonitis. Like when you know they have so little time that everything they do needs to matter. That we can kind of draw more conclusions from a scene's inclusion than we maybe otherwise would in a mid season episode. So let's keep going. Back to Dragonstone. This is sort of the second part of Dragonstone. Again, I was very just happy that they returned to Dragonstone and took even more time teasing this out, just because it's the kind of thing that, you know, could have just gotten one scene, and a lot of times those kind of interactions do, and instead it didn't. So we get Tyrion kind of working both ends. If Tyrion just dies in the next episode, Tyrion earned his entire, like, he earned everything in this episode by, like, doing such good back channeling. So he goes and he has this great scene with Jon where they're both overlooking the ocean, sort of reminiscent of them on the wall in season one. And he tries to convince John to just give Dany more time. I think he did a really good job in that scene explaining to John what exactly he was asking, like that this random guy just rolled in and said, there's monsters in the north, divert your whole army and come help me. And she's like, dude, I don't even know you. What the hell? And so I thought he did a good job there. And then he meets with Daenerys and has a sort of similar thing, telling her, look, obviously, like, he's still a potential ally. You don't need to just throw this away because he won't bend the knee immediately. Give him something that he wants, like keep him talking to you. Like, you need allies. He is a potential ally, and sort of makes it work and moves heaven and earth and sort of lands a diplomatic deal, which I thought was just very effective diplomacy by Tyrion. Mm-hmm. What did you think?
Yeah, no, and it will be interesting to see if Jon just hangs out and minds and, like, gradually convinces Tyrion and Dany to see things his way. But yeah, no, I agree with your takes on that.
Yeah, it was. I think there were more, like, I liked when he talks to Tyrion about Grubkins and Starks. Like, there was some more discussion of sort of, do you believe me? Which I think is like an ongoing, it's a thing that could have been maybe more interesting if it had been a little better written, and if John was like a little more, if he was doing a better job of selling it, like the actor and sort of the character, like, because he's just so kind of like deer in the headlights, Kit Harington's performance, which, like, he's always kind of inscrutable. And so when he is really saying, look, I really need to, like, you know, to convince you that this is the truth, you don't get the sense that he's like, dude, holy shit, you will not believe what I have seen.
Right, because he always is on the same, he's always just on the same level. It's always just mopey John.
Right.
And I like Tyrion's comment about how he looks better moping than Tyrion could.
And even, like, that he doesn't include any, that was very funny, that he's like, oh, I wanted to brood, but you look so much. He looks over and John is standing there looking awesome with this amazing cloak looking. That was very funny. But that John doesn't include any detail. I would just think, if I were trying to convince somebody of the Night King, I would say, no, you don't understand. I made direct eye contact with him and he raised his hands and everyone that he had just killed came back to life and they all, like, I would tell the story. I wouldn't just say, the Night King is in the north. The Long Night is coming and the army will kill us all. end of story. That wouldn't be, I would be do a better job of selling it, and he just doesn't.
Yeah.
So they keep returning to this idea of, do you believe me? And Tyrion says, yes, I believe you. There's that funny callback to Tyrion talking about Grubkins and Snarks and then saying, well, but I heard it from more than one person.
The other thing is that if Melisandre had stayed, maybe they would have actually been able to convince
him. Exactly. Daenerys. Which is, again, like her saying last episode, oh, well, you need to hear it from him. It, you know, it makes sense that she wants Daenerys to hear it from Jon, and she wants to get them together, I'm sure, because she's aware of some prophecy involving them or something. But, like, for her to be there would have been helpful. Mm-hmm. I did really like, I think that this show has been, there have been some interpretations out there that I think are fair about how this is sort of about global warming, or, like, at least there are some parallels about climate change in, like, the discussion between Sam and the Archmaester, where the Archmaester was saying, well, you know, we thought the world was going to end here, and we thought the world was going to end here, and it didn't.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that the way, I thought Tyrion got a really cool, really well-written line, I thought, in his conversation with Jon, where he said, basically, no one is going to be able to reckon with this problem because it's too big.
Right, because it's so abstract.
Like,
and
the
big,
problem
yeah.
that you're describing is, like, this, you know, fundamental, like, existential problem of,
right.
like, zombies coming to kill us all. And he's like, he just says, basically, there are some problems that people just can't deal with. They need to deal with, you know, the thing that's right in front of them. And I thought uh-huh. that was, you know, that definitely applies when we think about climate change. It's so hard to think about. It's so scary and so big. And it's much easier to just think about whatever the current, you know, the moment-to-moment controversy of the day or the news
right.
or whatever. And I thought that was just like a cool, it was just a good line because it was universally true
uh-huh.
and well-delivered and well-written, I thought. So I liked that. And Daenerys, jury is, she says the jury is out. Doesn't seem as though she's totally convinced or unconvinced.
Yeah, another, yeah, the other interesting theme that I mentioned before of this episode is people acting like their parents. And a lot of people, there was a lot of mm-hmm. talk of like, John, his advisors telling him not to go south because his father went south and didn't fare pretty well out of that. He didn't fare so well.
No.
And how John suspects that Daenerys is going to be like her father. And a lot of interesting themes around that, especially when we eventually find out, or when John eventually finds out who his real father is.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see more. And I wonder, I kind of wish that the show did flashbacks. Maybe we will get to see a flashback where we actually see Rhaegar and see what he was like, because
yeah.
there have been conflicting views. Like, Robert Baratheon thinks that he's a rapist and a horrible person who stole Lyanna Stark, but other people, and it's kind of more generally accepted that Rhaegar was this good guy and he did right and would have been a great king. So mm-hmm. it would be interesting to see him and then to see the parallels between him and Jon, and much like we've heard all the parallels between Aerys Targaryen and Daenerys.
Right. Yeah, it was cool that they drew the parallels, but then also kind of, it was a big part of their argument, right, was that Daenerys said, but also I am not my father. And he said, well, your father,
right.
you know, killed my, you know, whatever, I guess at the time, grandfather. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, okay, cool. You're not your father. Well, I'm not bowed by my ancestors' vows. Like, we're both our own thing, which also ties back to, I think, a scene that I really liked. It was a little corny, but that I liked in the last season, where Yara and Theon and Daenerys and Tyrion, and they all said, basically, we're all the children of horrible men.
Yeah.
And it's our duty, basically, to fix the world that they fucked up,
uh-huh.
which has sort of been this running theme. And, like, I like the idea that even though Jon is descended of decent, you know, noble people, he still is not his, you know, he's his own man.
Well, Aerys was his grandfather, so it's still descended from.
Also true, right, that he's, you know, or he was raised by, I guess, is not descended from. So moving on to Winterfell, Sansa is taking care of business in Winterfell. Seems like she's doing a very good job. She has a really intense conversation with Littlefinger where he's like, lets a little view into his head and how he thinks of things. And then Bran shows up. Sansa's very psyched to see Bran. Bran is very weird with Sansa. They have an intense conversation in the in front of the Weirwood tree. And Bran basically like just tells her that he was watching when she was married to Ramsay and sort of makes her relive that, which is sort of messed up. And then she just leaves. And Bran just seems very weird. So I know you're not a fan of Bran in this episode. So maybe
Bran just sucks the entire show. Bran has just sucked. He's just been the worst character. His dumbass moves were responsible for Hodor, not only Hodor dying, but Hodor becoming mentally disabled and just getting stuck in time and just his mind getting totally fucked up as a result of that. he's also made all like so many dumb mistakes and been such a waste of screen space. And I also think that he's the worst actor on the show, like by far. And that might be his direction, as Tim Archman pointed out to me on Twitter. We were talking about this briefly last night. But because he's given the direction of like, be this cold, like humanity-less person. But I think he's always been a bad actor. And it's tough to tell with child actors. And obviously child actors are going to grow up and you have no idea how they're going to turn out.
Right.
But Bran has just been terribly performed the entire show and is just such a bad character and such a useless character. And if his ultimate destiny is to just participate in this war with the Night King through mental magic or whatever the fuck, or like going back in time and changing things, then no matter what, it's gonna suck, and everything about him sucks. Man, I hate Bran so much.
Yeah, I'm not as anti-Bran, but I agree with what you're saying, only in that like it seems like a kind of a confluence of, yeah, child actor who maybe grew up to not be super strong, weird direction, weird decisions with just how they're handling him. They just haven't shown him very much. And him and what's her name? Reed.
Mira.
Mira Reed. We haven't gotten to see them together. They don't have any chemistry. They never talk. There weren't any scenes that gave us a sense of what Bran was going through. Bran basically lost his identity, like his self at some point. Mm-hmm. And now that's just happened. So he has no self anymore. And he's basically Dr. Manhattan, right? He's like Dr. Manhattan from Watchmen. He's existing at all points, at all
Watchmen.
Moments at
that's
once.
Funny. Oh, really? I just watched it over the weekend.
So bad. The book is good. But in the book does a better job of showing this. Like,
yes.
You know, they show Dr. Manhattan and he's like existing like on the frames. You'll see him living multiple timelines at once. Mm-hmm. And it gives him this detached sense from the world. And that seems like, I guess, what being the three-eyed raven is.
Right. And he doesn't even explain, like, he could have just said, okay, listen, I've become this psychic creature, blah, 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 and like explain to Sansa in words that she would understand. But instead, he's like, no, I'm the three-eyed raven now. Oh my God. Right. So stupid.
Well, it was a little bit.
The fucking like her being mutilated and raped, and oh my God, like what is he? How
it was very. It was a very Lost-ish scene because it was a scene where somebody speaks sort of gnomically and doesn't say the thing that just outright say the thing he could
season
say.
Season 6 of Lost.
And the worst of Lost. And it felt that way. It was a kind of frustrating scene. And it was interesting because he says, you know, I need to speak with John, which makes us think, okay, like he really does know. Because it is like he hasn't actually ever said outright like that he knows who John is. Like we assume that he does, but there wasn't ever a scene where he confirmed it. The camera confirmed it for us, like the cut from the baby's face to John's face, right? Like that. We know, and also we just had the theory, but like
yeah,
Bran
I'm
has
sure,
never said,
sure
I now know this information.
It's safe to assume that he pieced it together.
I think that by now it is, but at the same time, we are assuming it. So him saying, I need to speak with John indicates, yes, he definitely like 100% has internalized this and is going to tell John. Mm-hmm. And then not telling Sansa and sort of just being really weird. Yeah, sort of a frustrating scene. I spend all the scenes. It was cool. I liked Littlefinger basically saying his like crazy way of viewing the world.
And then Bran actually viewing it.
And then right, Bran actually sees the world that way. Like Littlefinger is like, you need to see all possibilities and watch everything happening at once. And Bran is like, I actually see everything. I thought that was kind of cool. And like a little bit of an insight into Littlefinger, who has always kind of been a bit of a mystery, sometimes to the character's detriment, like that we don't really know his deal other than that he's kind of creepy and he really liked Catelyn and he really likes Sansa. So that was,
Yeah, that always appeared to be his motivation, that he just loved Catelyn, and then by extension, he loves Sansa because she reminds him of Catelyn.
But it just seems like, I think like understanding the way that he thinks a little bit is sort of interesting, and that does sort of match with him, that he would be just constantly, like obsessively fighting and working everything through in his mind and figuring out who's going to come out on top.
Yeah, I don't remember how much of this was revealed in the show, but in the books, his backstory is that he grew up with Catelyn and Catelyn's sister, and he was in love with her. And
I believe that there is a scene, I think that the scene of John and Littlefinger in the crypt last season was a mirror of a scene between Ned and Littlefinger.
That was this season. John and Littlefinger were in the crypt this season.
Yeah, that's what I meant. Sorry, I meant last episode. Is kind of a mirror of a scene that happened in the first season between Ned Stark and Littlefinger. And I believe in that scene, Littlefinger does talk about how they were friends as kids, and like he never thought, I don't remember what the hell he said, but I do believe that it was at least talked about somewhat. So it's the same in the show as in the book.
Gotcha.
So yeah, I don't know. Like, I like Sansa taking control and being good at things. I really hope that she doesn't screw up and like trust Littlefinger in some way, but it's nice to see her.
And I actually really enjoy, of all the Stark kids, I think she's the most enjoyable to watch. And I think she is good in a way that other actors.
Yeah, the actress has grown into it.
What's Sansa's name?
I'm forgetting. She's really well known too. She's super cool. But I forget her name. Yeah, look her
up. I'm looking it up. It is Sophie Turner. Yeah, she's Sophie good, Turner. I think.
I also I went to a Game of Thrones press screening once in San Francisco. This was like maybe four seasons ago. And it was the premiere, and there were a bunch of them were there. So Arya and Sansa were there. So those actresses were there, and George R. R. Martin was there. And I was actually kind of sitting not that far behind them. And Sophie Turner is really, really tall in real life. She's like 6 feet tall.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed how... I think that a lot of times movies and TV shows will specifically like angle shots so that the men don't look short. Like Tom Cruise movies always do this because Tom Cruise is not a tall man, and he's sometimes cast with women who are taller than him. But I'm sure in his contract, he like stipulates that he can never look short.
Uh-huh.
And I really liked how there's a scene where she's walking next to Littlefinger, and they clearly shot it. So they like let her just be, you know, 2 inches taller than him, or maybe even, you know, accentuated that, and it just makes her look very strong and makes him look smaller than her, which is just sort of fun because she is actually a very tall woman, which is funny. Okay, moving on. Let's Old Town briefly. Sam cured Jorah Mormont. That's basically what happened. This is the same thing where they wouldn't have dedicated all this time to this if Jorah wasn't going to go do something. Mm-hmm. I don't love Jorah as a character. I've never really like gotten into him. I don't know. What did you think of the fact that Jorah is now cured?
Yeah, they're clearly setting us up for like 3 episodes from now when we've forgotten about him, for him to come and save Danny from like some crazy moment and just show up like heroically stab someone in the back, and then the camera pans up and it reveals Jorah Mormont saving the day. But maybe not. I don't know. They could pull a Game of Thrones and subvert our expectations, and maybe Jorah just dies on the way to Daenerys and never sees her again. That would be fun. I'm more interested in Sam's plot, because I actually thought, I was predicting that the Archmaester was going to be like, okay, you're done here, you're kicked out, and that would be the way for Sam to get back into the swing of things with Jon, maybe come to Dragonstone, rejoin Jon, meet Daenerys, and it would be fun to see Sam interacting with all those people. Maybe set up for Sam to go fight his father. But no, he's still studying, he's still training to be a maester, which is interesting.
Yeah, I liked that sort of reaction. I thought was just cool, like the sort of surprise, you're not actually in huge trouble. I also thought it was funny that he was sentenced as punishment to copy a whole bunch of manuscripts and books.
I don't think that was a punishment. I think that was just his regular duty.
Oh, it seemed to me like he was saying, this is your punishment. He was like, what, you thought you were going to get rewarded? Because I was like, well, actually, like, compared to what Sam was doing 2 episodes ago when he was like emptying bedpans and like vomiting, like this is a huge, like, I would love to copy books.
Or
after
even compared to what
that.
He was doing when he cured Jorah. Literally puncturing skin and like, how did, another thing that I was wondering about is like, how do you do that? Was Sam wearing gloves? I don't remember. Because if he was. What if, I thought it would be a cool twist if it turned out that Sam like got grayscale as a result of
that. At the end of the scene, there was, he was wearing gloves during the procedure, but then at the end, he shakes Jorah's hand, and I think it's like meant to be, they show them shaking hands, and he's saying, you're cured, I cured you, and I trust you to touch me, but like, Jorah shakes his hand with his right hand, and then puts his left hand sort of on top of the handshake, which is his fucked up grayscale hand, and I was just like, dude, I don't know, I mean, you cured him and everything, but I would be like, you know what, it's cool, like, we can just sort of like, you know, fist bump from a distance and not actually touch, because so I guess you like got the grayscale off his skin, but is he not contagious anymore? Like, I there are enough questions in it that I wouldn't want to get it, that I was sort of surprised
are,
by that.
Yeah, and I'm still, it's still ridiculous, and I think a lot of people have brought this up over the past week, that the cure, the mysterious cure cut off his skin.
My
actually, the
archer,
the Jim Broadbent's character brings that up as like, oh yes, the cure was to cut off his skin. And then
he does mention the unguent, like the salve that he must have put on, and maybe that was difficult
to
do
thing.
Or something.
Sure.
But they do, they keep saying, oh, this is a very difficult procedure and no one could do this. And it's like, well, I mean, I guess we didn't really see it. Maybe it's harder to do. Or maybe it's just that the maesters mostly do kind of brutal medieval shit, like, and that they aren't very advanced, which sort of makes sense, I guess.
So let's get to the best part of the episode.
So the best part of the episode, the most fast-moving, extremely eventful last maybe 10 minutes of the episode is definitely a lot of surprises, a lot of stuff happens. Tyrion talks through his strategy, and as he does so, it is intercut with us seeing at first it finally working the way he said, as the Unsullied take Casterly Rock. Then, of course, we have the moment where the Unsullied
through the arrived. Sewers. That was a really cool moment. They took it through the sewers that Tyrion had built, and through this escape passage he built so he could have sex with prostitutes in Casterly Rock.
Yes. I enjoyed that. And so they open it. They open the door. The Unsullied run in. There's this whole kind of uplifting thing about how the Lannister men are fighting because they're afraid, and the Unsullied are fighting for something they believe in, and they're going to take it. And they take it, and then Grey Worm looks around.
That was really well done, I thought. Really great like production values, and the narration was really well done. I thought it was a really cool
set. Yeah, there was some of the CGI looked a little funky to me. Like, there were some scenes of the troops where it looked a little, you know, Lord of the Rings, like CGI troops running indoors and stuff. But generally, looked this whole sequence, I thought, looked really good. This season has looked really good. Though I'm more into the big, beautiful shots of Dragonstone. Like, some of that stuff is just incredible looking. Where the battle sequences, I'm like, all right, I've seen a medieval battle sequence in a movie before. Pretty cool. So then, of course, Grey Worm realizes, wait a minute, there aren't enough people here. And that's when everything goes to shit for Daenerys' side. So first, Euron comes out of nowhere and, like, trashes the Unsullied fleet. So the Unsullied are trapped in the castle. It turns out Jaime has led the Lannister troops to Highgarden unexpectedly to strike at Olenna Tyrell. I was really surprised by this and made a note to something that I mentioned earlier, which was that this episode was so concerned with dialogue and so not that into showing combat, which of course I think is partly because showing the taking of Highgarden would have been very expensive, but also does show where the episode's priorities lie. We're in the last 10 minutes and they just show these troops arrive at Highgarden. Olenna Tyrell looks out and sees them, and then boom, next cut, it's over. Like, they took Highgarden.
Yeah, because you know what? First of all, a budget is obviously a concern, but also I think there are going to be so many battles to come that, like, this is such a minor one in the grand scheme of things that we didn't even need it.
Sure, we're going to get some big throwdowns. But again, it was just nice that the focus was on the character scene. So let me just finish the recap.
Okay.
Highgarden has been taken. Jaime walks in. Olenna is defeated.
Well, Jaime, I'm sure you caught this, but Jaime is marching with Sam's father, Randall Tarly.
Yes. And so, with Bronn, we see Bronn.
And with Bronn, yeah. But the point is that the Tyrells didn't have much of an army because all their bannermen have betrayed
them. Yes, and that was why there was no battle. So yes, right, exactly. It clearly last episode Jaime was did convince.
Yeah, I knew that was going to be the case.
Yeah, of course.
No way, like, there was no more of a thing.
Of course. So they take Highgarden. Jaime walks in, and he and Olenna have a sort of conversation in which Olenna first tells him in no uncertain terms that Cersei is a monster. She's like, you know this, I know this, you'll see it before it's too late, but you're probably too far gone. He sort of, again, he talks through the really horrible ways that Cersei wanted her killed, Lady Olenna killed, and then says, but I talked her out of that. And yet again, we get not a horrible, violent death, but poison. And he gives her actually poison that, he says, well, there will not be any pain. It'll be very quick. She takes the poison and then is like, yeah, I fucking killed Joffrey. And I think she calls Joffrey a cunt one last time. Mm-hmm. And then he actually just storms out and leaves her there. And the last shot is her presumably about to die.
That I thought that scene between Jaime and Olenna was like an all-time favorite Game of Thrones scene for me. And
it was
made up for all the shitty chemistry between Jon and Dany. It's too bad that we're saying goodbye to Olenna because she was such a cool character. But I guess it was time for her to go. She doesn't have anyone remaining in the world anyway. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I think Highgarden was a really smart move for Cersei and crew to take, because Highgarden is where a lot of the food is in Westeros.
Yes.
It is known as it's full of granaries and vineyards, and it is the source of a lot of the food, and it is important for her to have. I think that, this was just Cersei outwitting Tyrion in strategy in battle, which is interesting and kind of out of character for Cersei, but
unexpected. We'll see. I think, foreshadowed a little bit looking back and really this all could have been Jaime. The more I think about it, I think it's likely that this is Jaime's strategy, only because when Cersei and Jaime were talking in the first episode of the season, he mentioned the food thing and said, Highgarden has all the food and they're against us. We're running out of food because we've
destroyed
the kingdom.
And he's the one who convinced the Tarleys to betray.
Right.
And,
so Jaime's been doing a good job. Like, he is clearly, as much as he was a master swordsman, he is definitely doing a good job as a tactician. And it is kind of interesting to imagine this. This is why I kind of wish they'd established this a little bit more, that this was Jaime's strategy, which maybe they will in the next episode. But I like...
Or maybe, I mean, it's some things can be left for us to piece together ourselves.
But I really like this as an idea of Jaime and Tyrion basically like against one another, because they've always had an odd relationship, and I actually really like their relationship, and I'm very interested to see how it ultimately resolves itself. Because as much as Tyrion and Cersei have this clear, you know, enmity and they don't like each other, Jaime, of course, he let Tyrion go, and then Tyrion went and killed their father. Like, there's been this sort of ongoing thing where Jaime always loved Tyrion and Tyrion like worshipped and loved Jaime. And so the fact that they're kind of now like plotting a war from either sides, and actually Jaime is kicking Tyrion's ass pretty consistently, is interesting to me. And I hope they talk more about that, just because
they'll do is maybe we'll see some disagreement between Cersei and Jaime, and maybe Cersei wants to make more aggressive moves and Jaime is like no, and maybe that's how they'll show it. But as for Jaime and Olenna, man, that scene, so the sparks are flying. Olenna is incredible, just a great way for her to go, saying a final fuck you to the Lannisters, telling Jaime that she killed his son. I think Jaime must have so many conflicting feelings, because on one hand, it's Jaime's son. On the other hand, Jaime knew that Joffrey was like a piece of shit, like a royal piece of garbage. And this isn't like Myrcella, where Myrcella was just a sweet, innocent girl who did nothing wrong. This was Olenna stopping a tyrant, stopping a monster from being in control of the realm and hurting Olenna's granddaughter. So like Olenna was totally justified in killing Joffrey. And Jaime must have, like, all these thoughts must be running through his head, like this rage towards her for killing her son, but also he knows that she's right about Joffrey and about Cersei turning into the new Mad King. And this is certainly not the last we have seen of Jaime having conflicting feelings and eventually perhaps having to reckon with the fact that he is now serving yet another Mad King or Queen and has to figure out what to do.
Yeah, it seems like the poetic directions in which that is heading, that the Kingslayer himself must now reckon with being Kingslayer once again for his own sister. Like a lot of that stuff that's happening is definitely good. And he just, whatever that guy, Nicolaj Coster, however you pronounce his name, the actor who plays Jaime, is just very, very good.
Oh yeah, he's fantastic.
When he could just be this sort of chiseled, good-looking guy, he's a really good actor.
He's really good performance.
He's done his best work, I think, when he's opposite... You know, he did really good stuff with Brienne in earlier seasons, and now in that scene with Lady Olenna, I agree. I thought that was a great scene and a cool ending. And I liked just that it moved. It swept so much off the board. So the dynamic is completely shifted three episodes in from where I was at the beginning, which I think is very, very interesting, and kind of it brings the whole conflict in Westeros to a more understandable place. Because clearly now, so we've got basically an alliance between the North and Daenerys. Daenerys, though, is like in... Her entire negotiating position with Jon has changed, because I think the Unsullied are probably fucked. Like, they don't have any food and they're trapped in this castle. I get the feeling, especially because we got that big scene with Missandei and Grey Worm. Like, Grey Worm kind of got closure on his character. He's probably screwed and going to die.
Oh, yeah.
And so they've got there. That's basically one of her fighting forces down. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you know, her two armies that she was going to get are both, we're assuming Dorne is out of the picture. Highgarden is toast, and the Tyrells are finished. So that kind of leaves her in a way weaker position than she was in, especially if she loses a dragon.
Yeah, it's interesting, because at the end of last season, when you see the last shot of season 6 was her on these boats with this giant, massive fleet, three dragons circling, and you're just like, oh my god, Westeros is fucked. But now she gets there, and she finds that Cersei is a larger force than she had expected to reckon with, and I think that's really interesting and really smart of the show to create the situation where Daenerys is still gonna have to go through some struggles, and like she hasn't reached the end of her arc, even though it was tempting to believe that like her retaking Meereen and getting everyone finally crossing the sea and getting to Westeros, that was going to be the end for her. And now she would finally get to take her rightful place as the Queen of Westeros. But no, it seems like the real battles have yet to come for her. And we'll see what she has to suffer and what she has to lose.
And that was, I think, another, actually, speaking of the acting in the scene with Kit Harington and Emma Clark when they first met, I thought that was actually a really great moment for her, was when she said, she basically recounted everything she's been through, mm-hmm. and talking about, she was like, I was sold, I was raped, I was abused, I was like taken by all these different people. And every time, like, I came through it and like I built myself to where I am now from nothing. And it was, I think, a really well done, well written monologue. And it's true that like she's gotten here and she kind of has everything, but then she's lost a lot already. And it's, you know, now kind of an open question, who will necessarily win this war? Like it, mm-hmm. And I think that an important thing to keep in mind as we go into future episodes is that the reason that Daenerys is where she is because she didn't want to kill everybody in King's Landing. She didn't want to just attack King's Landing directly. And that was part of her strategy with Tyrion. And she may start questioning that. I mean, she could have just ended this whole thing if she had just showed up and immediately gone and taken Cersei out. And instead, she's lost her whole army, basically, and is now at a disadvantage because she wasn't willing to do the thing that Olenna told her to do
we were talking about that last week, about that question, and like, who's right, Tyrion or Olenna? And now, even as Olenna dies and she says her final fuck yous to Jaime, it becomes clearer that she had the right of it. Daenerys should have listened to her and should have just gotten it over with. But then who knows what kind of consequences that would have had if they had just raised King's Landing to the ground.
Exactly. So. Like, what would have really been the right decision? So a couple of missing people from this episode. The Hound, we again didn't see. Hopefully we'll see him next week. Mm-hmm. Arya, we also didn't see. Though I kept watching the scenes in Winterfell and being like, who's got the Mission Impossible mask on?
Yep.
Who's the one? Where is Arya? Is Arya that guy who's like walking with Sansa and Littlefinger? Is that actually Arya? So I'm sure when Arya turns up at Winterfell, she doesn't like do it with a Mission Impossible mask, but I think
also,
she probably
you know
will.
What? I said before that Sansa was the best of the Stark children. That's not true. Maisie Williams is the best actor.
Yeah, Maisie
of the
Williams
Stark children.
Is good. They're
but
both
Sophie
great,
Turner
though.
Is also, yeah, they're both
I'm actually
good.
Really looking forward to their reunion because they had such a like shitty relationship when they were little, and now they've both mm-hmm. grown and changed so much. And I'm really psyched to see that because I love both of them. And,
yeah,
and
it's funny. The Stark boys all suck, and the Stark girls are just awesome.
Yeah. It's kind of a like running theme in Game of Thrones, really. Like, it's sort of true of a lot of those families.
It's true.
So moving along, the Night King we did not see yet again. I'm sure you're very happy about that. We didn't see Tormund and his detachment heading up to Eastwatch by the Sea. I'm assuming we'll maybe check in with them
at some point.
One of the next couple episodes, and then they'll be like the climactic battle will be there.
Sure.
And that's like where the Night King will breach the wall or whatever. That's my assumption. And we didn't see anything else happening at the Night's Watch, except we knew they sent Bran down, which is fine because there's not really anything major happening up at the wall. So really, we kind of... Considering there weren't that many, it didn't seem like there were that many concurrent storylines in this episode. We basically saw everybody except Arya and the Hound.
Yeah.
And that's kind of an indication of how much the show's scope has narrowed and how many people are now on the same tracks, that they only have like four or five tracks kind of going. When at one point in this show felt like there were like 18 different tracks going, and each episode would just be a really quick 10-minute check-in with, you know, six of them. Mm-hmm. And then we would just move on next week and wouldn't hear from half the people. So
yeah,
it's the
consolidation was necessary. They needed to do this, and they only have 10 episodes left after this. So cool, good episode.
Definitely
another solid one, and we will be back again next week.
We'll be back later this week to talk about video games.
But that doesn't, this is a separate,
people who listen to this don't care about that.
We will be back on Thursday with your regularly scheduled split screen.
Yep. All right, talk to you then, Jason.